Is that amplified at all?
That's this one.
Oh, I see. Okay. Good afternoon. So that you may adjust your temporal expectations, I'd like to announce that my preliminary address will last some 15 minutes and will be followed by a talk of not more than an hour, by Mr. Fuentes. My words will not be totally devoid of celebratory praise, but they will be, in the main, historically descriptive and occasionally critical. When one thinks of the leading figures of the contemporary Latin American narrative, that other narrative, that marginal narrative, the inscription of whose marginality locates it firmly within the Western tradition, a handful of names comes to the mind of most devotees. In addition to the master Borges, there are Cortázar, García Márquez, Vargas Llosa, Donoso, Cabrera Infante, who are held in virtually undisputed esteem for their conceptual depth and technical virtuosity. These authors together have taken, in roughly the time of one generation, a provincial and derivative literature and converted it into a vital and pulsating organism of global scope. They have established a convincing collective voice, carved out a Latin American identity, and founded a vast readership that renders problematical national and even international boundaries. They have undertaken the renewal of the Spanish language by opening it to multiple planetary influences: black dialects, indigenous languages, the language of commerce and of mass media, English, French, German, to name a few, all participate in this expansive project. To this current influx are added, by sheer intellectual will, neologisms, etymological usages, obscenities, the language of organized religion, as well as that of metaphysics and of semiotics. The radical inventiveness of this band of writers has forced literary criticism to coin new terms, such as magical realism and the neo-baroque, to somehow account for the textual innovations. And in what may be described as an amoebic movement, Latin American literature has ceaselessly absorbed literary theory as it has been disseminated from Western cultural centers. It has digested it and assimilated it into its very fictional structure, resulting in a paradoxically self-conscious and self-denying lacework of disconnected nodes, often of awesome complexity and opacity. The works of today's authors are so diverse as to defy categorization, unless we look at things from their underside and determine that their principal commonality is their unrelenting difference. Difference from the novelistic genre as it has come down to us, difference from each other's works, difference from each one's previous works, and finally, difference from each work in itself. Among those in the select Latin American circle, possibly the most explosive and enduring is our guest speaker this afternoon, Carlos Fuentes. Recognized as a playwright, essayist, and short story writer, Mr. Fuentes is still best known as a novelist. He gained considerable notoriety among Mexican readers with his first novel, La Región Más Transparente, Where the Air is Clear, in 1958. This Joycean epic of Mexico City voices a critique of contemporary society as it portrays the various mythologies underlying the Mexican national psyche. In 1959, Mr. Fuentes published Las Buenas Conciencias, The Good Conscience, a book of relatively modest ambitions, which nonetheless bears unmistakably the germ of the mature fiction he was to write in the next two decades. At one point in the novel, a friend of the protagonist, Juan Manuel Lorenzo, thinks, and I quote, "There ought to be another language that not only reflects, but that can transform reality," end of quote. It is to the articulation of just such an imaginative, autonomous, and self-referential language that Carlos Fuentes has directed his efforts ever since. In 1962, he published Aura, an oniric novella of exquisite structure and daring narrative technique. That same year saw also the appearance of La Muerte de Artemio Cruz, The Death of Artemio Cruz, a novel which provides a retrospective and kaleidoscopic view of the betrayal of the Mexican Revolution's cherished values. The successful manipulation of three cyclically recurring narrative voices, first person in the present, second person in the future, third person in the past, may well be what both brought this novel popular acclaim and established Fuentes internationally as a first-rate author. To date, La Muerte de Artemio Cruz, among all Fuentes novels, has attracted the most critical attention in this country. An extraordinarily prolific writer, Fuentes again published two novels within the span of 12 months. Zona Sagrada, Holy Place, 1967, features a reworking of the story of Ulysses' return to Ithaca, as told from the point of view of a narcissistic Oedipus type. Claudia Nerbo, the movie star mother of the contemporary Telemachus, projects an image that acquires the dimensions of desire itself. Every principal character and place and time in Zona Sagrada has its double, or opposite, or reflection. And this permutability of the novelistic elements has come to be the single most salient trait of Fuentes' recent works. The other novel published that year, Cambio de Piel, as its title indicates, its translation is A Change of Skin, is a play upon the multiple metamorphoses individuals and relationships can undergo. The four major characters, two men and two women, or a married and an unmarried couple, or two Mexicans and two foreigners, or three middle-aged persons and one relative youngster, etc., can be sliced along numerous axes. As the characters' roles transform and proliferate, one perceives in the interstices the eternally returning face of violence, religious, imperial, amatory, mechanical, and finally verbal violence. After that flood of productivity, Carlos Fuentes did not publish another full-length novel until 1975. But when Terra Nostra finally was complete, it was clear that, like Vargas Llosa's Conversation in a Cathedral and Donoso's Obscene Bird of Night, this gargantuan, Herculean, and in many ways quixotic work was Fuentes' bid for immortality. In the words of José Miguel Oviedo, quote, "What this novel wants to be is simply everything, a summa of human myths, a rewriting of history, an interpretation of Spain, an American reflection, a dissident essay on the function of religion, art, and literature in human destiny, a utopian proposal, a collage of other works, an erudite treatise, an adventure novel, a new dialogue on language, an examination of the past, a prediction of the future, and last but not least, an immense erotic poem," end of quote. Terra Nostra is, moreover, the representation of a cosmovision, the registry of a consciousness. We are treated in part one to a glimpse of the absolutism of Counter-Reformation Spain. In part two, to the pluralism imposed by the discovery and conquest of the New World. And in part three, to a kind of awareness which lacks a definitive label, but may be termed otherness, or negativity, or absence. If Carlos Fuentes never wrote another word after Terra Nostra. His place in history would still be secure. But as if in response to the sheer weightiness of that tome, he published in 1978 La Cabeza de la Hidra, The Hydra Head. This most recent novel of Fuentes appears designed for mass appeal. Its subject is the passionate question of oil reserves, vast oil reserves, discovered in the Gulf of Mexico, which make Mexico a power to be reckoned with in the late 20th century. The style is clean and devoid of ornamentation. The action progresses swiftly, repeatedly building suspense and mystery. What Cabeza de la Hidra does masterfully is combine readerliness with subtle parody of the spy thriller genre, refusing to conform to the demands of the formula at syncopated moments. With this most recent offering, Mr. Fuentes has again kept several steps ahead of his critics, demonstrating unsuspected flexibility and range. Those are Mr. Fuentes' major works. But of greater moment than the texts themselves are the ideas they evoke. Particularly striking is the active role both myth and ritual play in all Fuentes fiction. A primary concern is with the way we Westerners mythify our leaders, our movie stars, our sports idols, our political figures. We blow them out of proportion, simplify them, turn them into caricatures of stereotypes. Similarly, Fuentes' texts call into question the American dream, a Pollyanna optimism that refuses to grant validity to tragedy. And I hasten to add, they criticize with even greater severity the institution of Mexican machismo, whose tendencies toward senseless violence and sentimental reification of women constitute a kind of national trap. Drawing from the Greco-Roman, Judeo-Christian, and Aztec Maya traditions, Fuentes' writing reveals the multiple, interpenetrating, mythical layers that comprise modern Mexican culture. A typical Fuentes novel is circular in structure, etching a trajectory whose origins and conclusions are indistinguishable. Although we may dress our current events in new clothing, history, it is contended, is a toy of destiny, a continual reenactment of the same archetypal situations. We're made aware, too, of the myth of literature, as if imaginative works had some kind of magical truth value. And we're reminded that all artistic genres, from plays to poems to pictures, are ritualized cultural forms, as ritualized as the very session you are attending at this moment. Myth is ultimately shown to forge the configuration of the unconscious, creating our potential, but also limiting our freedom through the weaving of a web of inhibitions, a non-reflexive ideology. If we were to select the single most pervasive notion from the Fuentes repertoire, the one idea that reigns over his vast cognitive hierarchy, that privileged concept would probably be freedom. Freedom from taboos, freedom from poverty, freedom from political coercion, freedom from dogma, and freedom from our own obsessions. Fuentes' fiction stands as a monument to eccentricity, heterodoxy, aberration, and the triumph of the questing imagination. It refuses to accept. Indeed, it posits as impossible the acceptance of the status quo, no matter how recently attained. In The Limit, of course, freedom too can become an obsession. But it is safe to say that today, worldwide, freedom is a precious commodity, known principally for its scarcity. Such a schematic account of Carlos Fuentes' novelistic production admittedly commits a gross reduction and distortion of his works. His writing, for one thing, has always obeyed the impulse to inscribe a totality in the way that Heidegger aspires with the Dasein to posit the pre-origin of philosophy, and Hegel seeks to write the end of philosophy by circumscribing all of hermeneutics. I would apologize for the violence my words do Fuentes, except that my summarizing gesture amounts to a performance of one of the key notions underlying Fuentes' own words. Octavio Paz has said that in Fuentes' works, I quote, "the world is not presented as a reality that one must name, but as a word which we should decipher," end of quote. If the world is a word, that is, a sign or a text, then the words and signs and texts we use to describe the signified of that worldly text are hopelessly inadequate, trapped, as it were, in a chain of signification which can never reach that to which our words would refer. Considering Carlos Fuentes' 8 novels as one composite, highly ambiguous text, then, we may distill out the following overriding preoccupation. The truth is elsewhere. Or in the words of Emil Rodriguez Monegal, quote, "history is fiction, reality is apocryphal, the New Testament was written by Jules Verne," end of quote. By dealing at some length with Mr. Fuentes' novels, I have not intended to cast a shadow on his criticism. His collections of essays, House with Two Doors, Casa con Dos Puertas, the new Latin American novel, La Nueva Novela Hispanoamericana, and Don Quixote, or The Critique of Reading, demonstrate his breadth of culture, his incisiveness of intellect, and his thorough familiarity with contemporary Western thought, from television to teleology. He is currently at work on a novella titled Nombres, Names, a very suggestive name in itself, which, when juxtaposed to Rodriguez Monegal's dictum that history is fiction, yields the rough equivalent of the title of this afternoon's university lecture, Names, Novels, and Histories. It is both a personal pleasure and a professional privilege to welcome again to Ithaca's incendiary hills a person of immense accomplishments and exemplary dedication to his craft. I give you Carlos Fuentes.
Thank you very much, Professor Titler. Ladies and gentlemen, "Ocean, origin of the gods," exclaims the poet of the Iliad. And Plato echoes as he writes the first European treatise on language. "All things that refer to time have the sound of water. Ocean, origin of origins, and Cronus, the name of its course, river and time. Could Heraclitus be right, Socrates wonders, when he affirms that all things move, that nothing remains still, and that the universe is like the current of a river in which no man may bathe twice?" Plato, in his Critias, observes that all etymologies of time imply movement and change, except the one that, as it questions time, arrests it. History, which in Greek means inquiry, the dam that stops the flow of the water. As soon as he considers the problem of language, Plato finds himself uncomfortably immersed in the water of time. The Critias is in part an attempt to demolish the thinking, the philosophy of Heraclitus, since there would be no knowledge if its essence were subjected to the perpetual change that governs time and language. Critias, in the debate that goes on in the pages of this dialogue, Critias maintains that the names of things are intrinsic. It is nature and not convention that names. Hermogenes, another participant in the dialogue, on the other hand, believes that the only reality names possess is that granted them by convention. Socrates makes himself the third point in the triangle and enters the discussion to question whether Protagoras, when he says that man is the measure of all things, eliminates the possibility that things possess a reality of their own, fixed and objective. First, he believes that as things obviously have a reality of their own, one not determined by our whim, and that as the act of naming is an instrument to facilitate the communication of that reality, names are given by a legislator, an onomastic legislator, whose authority consists on bestowing upon things the names they deserve. That is, the absolute or ideal name, the constituent, essential reality of that thing. Such an onomastic demiurge would have to be as much a substantialist as Plato himself. The illusory character of this undertaking quickly becomes apparent to Socrates. The legislator creates the name, he says, but the dialectician uses it. And simply by paying good coin to the sophists, he says, we will not learn the true name that we know dialectically in its usage, but not originally in its essence. Can there be any doubt that some are very well named? Astyanax, he says, son of Hector, lord and defender of the city inherited from his father, and Agamemnon, whose name means admirable for his endurance, the Homeric prefiguration of that Faulknerian breed that not only endures but prevails. Admirably named are all heroes, says Socrates, who share the root of their identities, love, with Eros, heroes, and Demeter, goddess of the fruits of the earth, whose etymological sign is conveyed in Meter, mother, and who is Hera, daughter of time and wife in continual controversy with her husband Zeus, but the imitation of language as air and time. The very act Socrates proposes of respiration, Hera, 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 hot fumes and furious minutes. On the other hand, what can one say of poor Hermogenes, the questioner of Socrates and Crotylus, whose name derives from Hermes, the most sagacious financier on all Olympus, a talent which is this insolvent and spendthrift Hermogenes, our friend, lacks completely. And is it not true that men abound who are named Theophilus, but who are not distinguished by their love of God? What happens when the dialectician, distorting onomastic decree, calls the offspring of a cow a horse and the offspring of a mare a bull? No one would choose falsehood if he knew the truth, says Socrates. But the truth can disguise itself as falsehood in the same way that compulsion can mask itself as desire. That is why death, the final stage of life, detains so many men in its domain. Pluto, the king of hell, the king of death, whose name means giver of riches, has succeeded in surrounding himself with such abundance that he manages to deceive souls and to convince them that this compulsion, death, is their desire. Pluto makes his deceit credible because he avoids contact with the mortal body and accepts only the society of souls freed from the impure intentions of the flesh. A Tristan without Christ, a Cathar with a powerful constituency, Pluto takes advantage of our confused aspirations for a purity that would compensate for our bodily suffering and thus makes of death the soul's desire. Pluto's modern name might be Ivan Karamazov, in the name of the paradise of enchained freedom, and Vautrin, in the name of the power of worldly will, and the narrator of À la recherche du temps perdu, in the name of the impossible coincidence of Swann and Charlus and Odette and Albertine and Gilbert and Guermantes with their names. The modern victim, finally, the eternal Faust, written with a capital K. the meticulous and logical exposition of the alternatives of the law traveled by Kafka certainly does not constitute justice, but it does keep it alive. And justice, the French philosopher Alain wrote one day, not only exists in words, but first it exists in words. Plato, who does not hold men of letters in great esteem, does not fall into these traps. And he reveals the deceit of Hermes, which is similar to that of Pluto and identical to that of Kafka's messengers. Though he is identified with the power of speech, Hermes, the messenger of the word, the purported interpreter of the gods, cannot even give us the true names of the divinities. There is no messenger, there is no writer. Who can tell us those names, the true names of the gods? For it is clear that among themselves, the gods address one another in a manner different from our own. They use their true names, and we do not. It is Hermes who is guilty. He circulates words like money and robs them of their permanence, which is the same as their essence. He makes words double, sometimes true, sometimes false, always worn thin. From this ambivalence, the moderns will make novels. And no one will ever know whether Heathcliff is truly Heathcliff, because to know that would be to rob him specifically of the very ambiguity that makes him a character in a novel. Like his name, sometimes true, but sometimes false. Is Quixote Quijano, or is Quijano Quixote? And if Quixote is Quixote, is he not merely a caricature of Amadís de Gaula, whose true epic will not tolerate the doubts with which Cervantes serves two masters, falsehood and truth? Is Vautrin his historical model, Vidocq? Or is he the sum of his successive identities within Balzac's novel, Jacques Collin, Trompe-la-Mort, the Abbé Herrera? Or is he simply the decantation of his own literary tradition, that of the Latin, medieval, and Spanish pícaro, domesticated finally by a society of wealthy rogues and named by this society precisely because of his dishonesty, chief of the Parisian police, the gendarme of thieves? Antiquity resolves contradiction in tragedy. All conflict is transferable to the sphere of values because the absolute that measures them is always present, but it is also by its very nature forever absent physically. The modern age resolves ambiguity in the novel. The absolute has been first subverted and then destroyed. It always was unattainable at any rate, a mystic falsehood, a rational impossibility, but suddenly, says Hermann Broch, it appears in the work of art. And art, adds the author of The Sleepwalkers, is the miracle of man's humanity. If not the miracle, the amazement of modern art is that it is comprehensible only in its radicalization of the relative, the ambiguous, the uncertain, and acceptable only as a substitute for the absolutes, which in order to found its ambiguous modernity, it destroyed. Art, the enemy of the heaven it occupies, but also art, uneasy, very uneasy, in the stead of heaven. It was Franz Kafka who destroyed this consolation by returning modern art to its origins, the cellar, the underground, the basement, the grave, the dark root of the totemic pole. For Plato, a name can be true only if it demonstrates the nature of what it names. This correspondent demands a knowledge of the immutable, ahistorical origin of things and their names. But as soon as it is steeped in the waters of time, this identity is transformed into a caricature of itself. What in substance is unified is made double in accident. The pretension of locating truth within a time frame would be to reproduce exactly two Protagoras, two Hermogenes, two Socrates, and once all things are duplicated, nothing resembles itself, and it is no longer possible to distinguish truth from falsehood. Substantial reality relies only upon an image to be recognized, and that image is of necessity partial, a bare reflection of the original Hittin case. How then are we to avoid deception? The deception of words and the deception of time, that running water that distances languages from an essential truth, that becomes increasingly less recognizable. The total freedom of time is inconceivable. Left to itself, Cronus devours his children, the children of time. It was necessary, warns Hegel, that Athena spring from the brow of Zeus and that Zeus create Apollo and the Muses in order to conquer time and to place upon it a limit to its self-devouring duration. For poetry, the only one of the literary arts that never abdicated its autonomy, the relationship between the word and time has always been resolved in a sense of tradition.